this problem that we looked at during the movement phase of the war, where there were a lot of rapes and sexual assaults going on that were unreported. When we looked at our systems, what we have at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, doesn't get replicated on the battlefield. So, Senator, there's a lot of work we got to do, and we got to fix this one so it doesn't happen again.
Thank you very much, Senator. Senator Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, a Democrat.
I express my gratitude not only for your service, but my support for the cause that the mission we have sent you to Iraq to carry out. I think it is the test of a generation, and I appreciate your confidence as you go forward, because it's going to have a lot to do with our future security. It makes why we're here all the more heartbreaking, infuriating, because it distracts us from that mission. But I absolutely agree with you. We got to go at this. I mean, casualties occur in war. The tragedy here is that this prison abuse scandal is a self-inflicted wound. But like any wound, we got to clean it up, fix it up, and then try our best to make sure it doesn't happen again. I want to express first my concern that on more than one occasion, at least two of you today, and your honorable people, obviously, under oath, have taken specific objection to parts of General Taguba's report. And that report has received a lot of credibility, and obviously I believe it was a report, General Sanchez, to you. And should we think less of it because of the objections that General Miller, in response to a question Senator Clinton asked, said that something that he was reported to have done or seen just didn't happen. And you yourself have separated yourself from conclusions in the report on a few occasions. Does it lead you to doubt the thoroughness of the report, or lead you to feel as the commander that you ought to send somebody else out there?
No, sir, it does not. As we have stated here, there are some differences and there are some concerns with our doctrinal foundations in the conduct of military police and military intelligence operations, and I think that is what is reflected there. We've got to fix those over time.
So the areas on which you disagree, and you've heard that General Miller has disagreed with General Taguba's report, you're pursuing in different ways then?
Sir, where I disagreed with the report was in my placing the 205th MI commander in charge of force protection.
Right.
And security of detainees. I believe that was exactly the right decision to make, given the circumstances, the tactical circumstances, and the warfighting conditions that existed.
So in that case, your disagreement is on a matter of judgment, really, not
absolutely
fact. Whereas
so.
General Miller, yours is a matter of fact.
Yes, sir. Mine is a matter of fact. The incident that Senator Clinton
just didn't,
forward,
by your testimony, happen.
That,
did
yes,
not
sir.
Happen.
That's correct.
Let me go on to a next concern of mine. It follows up on Senator Graham's questions, and in some sense it goes back to, let me preface this by saying and taking some notes myself. General Abizaid, you've said two things here today that I want to come back to. One is that, to the best of your knowledge, there was no pattern of prisoner abuse in your command. Second, that you expressed a belief that there were systemic problems that existed at Abu Ghraib that may have contributed to events there. And obviously we're all interested in trying to figure out when a reasonable person in a position of responsibility would have found that out. The decision by the Pentagon to send General Miller down the chain of command, but send General Miller, by your testimony, to Iraq, and then your decision, General Sanchez, to put Colonel Pappas involved, am I correct, General Sanchez, that you're saying that that decision was made because of your concern that conditions at Abu Ghraib were, as I think someone used the word, maybe you did yourself, dysfunctional? Is that correct?
Sir, that is exactly right. And it was dysfunctional in terms of the ability to defend the forward operating base. That was the judgment that I expressed in the issuance of that fragment.
Got it. But that's what I wanted to clarify. But at that time, the dysfunction that you saw in Abu Ghraib did not include your knowledge of prisoner abuse. Is that right?
Sir, that is exactly right.
And General Miller, I take it from your understanding of the reasons why you were dispatched to Iraq last fall, did not include, or did they, a concern about prisoner abuse?
Sir, they did not. We're not focused on the concern about prisoner abuse. They're about the overall capability of CJTF-7 to do to develop actionable intelligence, to do intelligence fusion, to see how interrogation.
So, your stress on the humane treatment of the Geneva Convention was of your own initiative, not because anyone, as they dispatched you to Iraq, had said, we think we got a problem of prisoner abuse.
So that is absolutely correct.
Let me now go to this chart that's received so much attention. I got to say again here, this was given, put before us by General Alexander, the general of the Army, who's in charge of intelligence. So the fact that it comes from a lower-ranking a company commander, Captain Woods, is surprising. Now, maybe it was given to us in the context of this investigation, because it's not all bad news for the Army. It does have a series of approved approaches for all detainees on the left here, which certainly to me seems reasonable. At the bottom, it lists safeguards, including approaches must always be humane and lawful. Geneva Conventions apply. Problem is this section here on the right, which Captain Woods was notifying anyone who saw this chart that required the General Sanchez's approval. Some of these seem reasonable. Some of them literally seem in violation of the Geneva Convention. And I wanted to ask you, Colonel Warren, two questions. One is how Captain Woods could have come up with these sections that he said required the commanding general's approval if the commanding general had not approved this chart. And secondly, do you agree with that the procedures listed on the right side, including environmental manipulation, sleep adjustment, sensory deprivation, are in fact violations of the Geneva Convention under all circumstances? Because I thought in your answer to Senator Reid earlier, you opened a door in which you were suggesting they might not be. And if so, I think it's very important for the committee to hear that.
My answer is that they are not. And this is why this cannot
these
be.
These are not violations of the Geneva Convention.
These are not in and of themselves, in isolation, violations of the Geneva Conventions. Specifically, the fourth convention, when applied to security internees, in this case, who are unlawful combatants,
which covers a number of the people at Abu Ghraib, is that right?
It does. It should cover those who, in this circumstance, would have been permissibly under active interrogation. As was pointed out by Senator Graham, some of the people depicted in these photographs could not have been under interrogation at all. They were of no interest. They were actually criminal detainees who should not have been in that cell block in the first place. But that, as an aside, sir. This is more complicated than a yes and no answer. Those things that were on the right that were placed there by Captain Woods, as I said earlier, sir, were placed there in order to show the range of the universe, if you will, of things that were not authorized. They were representative.
Where did he get the authority to not only put them down on the paper, but to say that they required the approval of General Sanchez? Well, I mean, he's a captain.
Sir, actually, it's a she. But I think I can explain that, sir, because, again, I was present throughout as this policy developed.
Please. And with the chairman's consent, if you just take a moment to
please
go over this.
If I might.
Witness will have adequate time to respond.
Thank you, sir. This goes back to General Miller's team's visit, where they looked at a broad range of interrogation and intelligence analytical operations. Their recommendation was that we should have an interrogation policy. We, as a task force, did not have one. We were focused on the tactical level of interrogations. We were following predominantly the Army field manual approaches. And in addition, we had other units, such as Alpha Company 519th Military Intelligence Battalion, which had served in Afghanistan, bring in their own policies that had been used in other theaters. Additionally, we had what we call the common law of interrogation approaches, and that is approaches which were variations on the authorized approaches contained within the Army field manual by way of implementation. So the point that was made to have a policy, I believe, was a reasoned and correct recommendation. And I was present at meetings in which... Reasoned and correct. Absolutely, sir. I believe we needed to have one as we moved our focus to the operational level, as we became more sophisticated, and frankly, as we wanted to stem the growth of this common law of interrogations so that we could regularize it, so that we could regulate it, and so that we should be able to provide proper oversight. So we took a number of these standard operating procedures and policies. Among them were those in use in Guantanamo Bay. Others were, as I mentioned, those that were imported into theater. We put together a team of folks who were military intelligence and legal officers. We looked at those policies. We reviewed them against the requirements that we believe were imposed by the Fourth Geneva Convention. We discarded some of those procedures, an example, sensory deprivation. We floated these through the command in a series of drafts. To be sure, in some of these drafts, specifically one dated 10 September, you may very well find all of those on the right-hand side, including sensory deprivation. But during the course of the staffing and the deliberative process and the review, and, sir, by no means is there a book that you can look up that runs through interrogation approaches and methods and has a check and a block that they comply or don't comply with the Geneva Convention. This is a matter of judgment, a matter of rigor, and a matter of oversight and interpretation. We came up with the interrogation policy first dated 14 September. We then sent that to Central Command, as General Sanchez described. During the course of the next 28 days, this deliberative and consultative process continued within the legal and the military intelligence community. It resulted ultimately in the 12 October policy. The 12 October policy, as I described, requires compliance with the Geneva Convention. It draws a legal contrast between prisoners of war and between security internees in turn for suspicion of hostile activity to the security of the state, and it requires the safeguards and the oversight mechanisms that I described. That policy contains only the field manual approaches which apply to enemy prisoners of war who enjoy the highest and most preferred status on the battlefield, plus segregation in excess of 30 days. When Captain Wood, at some point, we believe in October, prepared that slide, what I believe that she did was to take all of the approaches that were floating around the command, if you will, in various drafts and within the policies, list them to ensure that interrogators understood that only those things on the left were authorized without permission.
But again, you would say that of the group on the right, which has attracted the attention of the committee, the media, and the public, that as okay with General Sanchez's approval, that none of these are inherently or automatically in violation of the Geneva Convention?
In my opinion, they are not, sir. And this is why one has to read not just Article 31 of the Fourth Convention, but also Pictet's commentary and various legal treatises and interpretations of coercion as applied to security internees. And I'll make another point, sir, with regard to the environment in which we found ourselves. Remember that there were three Geneva Conventions initially in the 1929 iteration. After World War II, the fourth convention, the Civilians or Occupation Convention, was added. The body of case law, if you will, concerning interpretation of specific articles within the Fourth Geneva Convention is not very great at all. And in fact, as we worked through this, we did the best that we could do under the exigencies of the circumstances. And I am very comfortable, frankly, sir, with that 12 October policy that remained our policy for a period of 8 months. And if I might add one other thing, sir, it's very important, and this is the problem with a chart like this, it's very important that you understand the definitions which are contained, for example, in the field manual and the policy of some of those measures. A term I've learned in the past week in Washington, the optics are bad on that chart. But if you read the actual definitions, you'll find, for example, with regard to environmental manipulation, it sounds horrible. But the fact is that environmental manipulation can be as simple as, while at all times maintaining the minimum requirements of the Geneva Convention, that a person who cooperates in interrogations would get an air-conditioned room. A person who is not cooperating gets the minimum non-air-conditioned room. And each of those approaches has to be laid out in writing in an interrogation plan. Each of those interrogation plans is reviewed at the brigade level. For an exception to policy, it comes up for legal and senior intelligence review before going to the commanding general. So the intent of the chart, frankly, was to regulate, not to impose unlawful measures.
So though General Sanchez didn't see the chart before last week when General Alexander put it before us, it accurately reflects what you think is the appropriate policy for interrogation.
Those on the left and the safeguards, absolutely. Those on the right, again, are the range of the universe that are things that may very well in implementation not be authorized. In particular, given the intensity, the magnitude, the duration, the combination of measures, may very well, as Senator Reid suggested, violate the Geneva Conventions. You have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
And obviously you'd agree that a lot of what we've seen in pictures that occurred in the particular cell block in Abu Ghraib violated the Geneva Convention.
No question about it, sir. They also violated U.S. law, and that's why we're seeing courts-martial.
And this chart.
Absolutely, sir.
Thank you very much.
Maybe I shouldn't said speak
thank
up.
You,
well done.
Thank you very much, Senator. Senator Cornyn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess we can conclude that not even the combatant commanders can go very far without their
This is John Cornyn, Republican Senator from Texas.
I'm going to hire Warren.
I don't think any of us should be surprised that what I've counted up to be at least six separate investigations occurring in a war zone might occasionally come up, at least in a preliminary fashion, with some conflicts or gaps in the investigation. But I want to make sure that we understand at a baseline where we are. General Abzate, isn't it true that in basic training, our soldiers receive training on the Geneva Convention?
Yes, sir, that's true.
And also, prior to their deployment to the theater of operations, they receive retraining on the terms of the Geneva Convention?
They are supposed to, yes, sir.
Okay. And I believe that you've made very clear that under no circumstances, whether or not, no matter what the category of detainee may be, that at a basic minimum, everyone in the custody of the United States military is entitled to be treated humanely. Is that correct, sir?
That's correct, sir.
And I believe very strongly that in addition to the hearings we've had here, which hopefully will, after they conclude, allow our military to get back and do what we've asked you to do in Iraq and Afghanistan, that is defeat the enemy, that we've got to let our military justice process work. But General Sanchez, you suspended the entire chain of command, not just privates and corporals, on January the 17th or thereabouts. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
So just to make clear, no one is pointing the finger at the lowest level of our military food chain and saying you're at fault and the commanding officers are being protected. Is that right?
Sir, that is correct.
General Miller, I had the pleasure of traveling to Guantanamo Bay like a number of the committee have and meeting you there and was enormously impressed with that operation. There have been some who, during the course of these hearings, who've suggested that perhaps because of the various categories of detainees that we have in different locations, whether in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Guantanamo Bay, that perhaps there is some variation in terms of the acceptability of humane treatment. But would you also confirm for us that at minimum, everyone, regardless of their status at Guantanamo Bay or anywhere else to your knowledge, is entitled to be treated humanely?
Yes, Senator, every enemy combatant who is at Guantanamo is detained in a humane manner.
And in your opinion, General Miller, is the military intelligence that you've been able to gain from those who have recruited, financed, and carried out terrorist activities against the United States or our military, has that intelligence that you've gained saved American lives?
Senator, absolutely.
And would you confirm for us, General Abzate, that that's also true within the Central Command?
Senator, I agree that that's true. And I would also like to add that some of these people that we are dealing with are some of the most despicable characters you could ever imagine. They spend every waking moment trying to figure out how to deliver a weapon of mass destruction into the middle of our country. And we should not kid ourselves about what they are capable of doing to us. and we have to deal with them.
If we needed any other reminder of that, the death of Nicholas Berg, I believe, reminded us in a graphic fashion. But I, for one, am not troubled by the fact that some person who's trying to kill Americans is deprived of a good night's sleep in order to elicit information consistent with the Geneva Convention and our laws and humanity, information that might save American lives. And I consider you all American heroes and congratulate you for the job you're doing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator. Senator Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Abizaid, according to Washington Post on 5/8.
This is Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas.
Starting in August of 2003, Ambassador Bremer had concerns about the treatment of detainees and pressed the military to quote, improve conditions, and later made the issue of regular talking points and discussions with Secretary Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney, National Security Advisor Rice, end quote. The same Washington Post article notes that in August 2003, Ambassador Bremer, quote, after interceding in one detainee's case, urged the U.S. military in Iraq and top Bush administration officials to improve conditions and avoid potential fallout, end quote. General Abizaid, is that story, that statement I just read, is that essentially true?
Ambassador Bremer brought up to me on one of my many trips to Iraq on more than one occasion his concern about detainees.
Okay, so you were aware that Ambassador Bremer had concerns about the treatment of detainees, and were you also aware that he raised this matter with a wide array of senior administration officials?
I'm not aware of that, Senator, but as I understand the context of Ambassador Bremer's and my discussions, and also it's also the context of discussions that I had with many Iraqis as well, who were also talking to me about the detainee issue, it had to do with moving into the prison system, being lost sight of because we didn't have a good tracking system, not being able to get information to families in a timely manner. I mean, these were things that we were all concerned about. General Sanchez and I talked about them, and we certainly knew that the detainee system had to be such that we could identify people, track people through the system, and then release people in a timely fashion back to their families once we had determined that they served no intelligence purpose to us. Yeah. And until General Miller got there, well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, we were struggling with this very early on, and I won't make any excuses for it other than to say, when you take a country in the shape that we took it, everything was broken, and we were starting from zero. So
now, but are you saying that Ambassador Bremer did not have concerns about human rights violations?
I don't remember him. I mean, how you want to describe human rights violations? To me, the issue was, as far as the Arabs were concerned and Ambassador Bremer was concerned, it is human rights. It's, you know, my husband disappeared into your prison system, and now you guys can't find him. That's a human right problem, and I agreed with him, and Rick agreed with him, and we moved to fix it.
Okay. General Sanchez, let me ask you, were you aware that Ambassador Bremer had concerns about the prison system?
Sir, on many occasions, since the time I became the commanding general, CJTF-7, Ambassador Bremer and I had discussions about the detainee operations. We talked, as General Abizaid stated, about the identification, the in-processing, talked about the release procedures.
What about the treatment of prisoners and detainees?
And we also talked at some points about the quality of life of prisoners and the conditions that existed, especially during the summer and into the early fall.
Do you recall when he first brought those to your attention?
Sorry, it was not a matter of him bringing it up to my attention. It was general discussions that we were having.
You remember when those general discussions started?
Sir, we started having those in the midsummer time frame.
Okay. Let me ask
Senator,
this.
Senator, if I could just add, there's another issue here which I just want to make clear to the committee. It has to do with what goes on at the point of capture. I mean, this is not police work that we're dealing with. It's not arrest. It's combat and There were an awful lot of people in Iraq at the Iraqi Governing Council level that thought our troops were being too harsh in the way that they took people into custody. In my mind, having seen it personally on the battlefield, I thought, and I still think, it's some of the most professional work I've seen young troopers do anywhere. So we did have a different point of view in that regard.
Well, General Sanchez, let me follow up with you, if I may. When you mentioned you were having these general discussions about conditions and a variety of issues relating to the detainees, when did you first start to report that up the chain of command, and who did you report that to?
So there were multiple occasions when General Abizaid and I had the discussions, especially as they related to actions at the point of attack.
Here again, do you remember when that started?
As I stated,
immediately.
as soon as you were aware of it.
Senator, let there be no doubt. We knew there were problems in the detainee system, and we didn't think that there were a system of conditions existing out there such as we've seen in the photographs, but we knew that there were problems, and we moved to get them under control as quickly as we could. And when I say immediately, I took command in July, and I would imagine that besides talking about operational matters, one of the first things that the two of us talked about was, you know, how we've got to get this under control.
And General Abizaid, when you talked to your superiors, who did you talk to?
Well, sir, I can't recall specifically mentioning the problem to the secretary or to the chairman, but on one of their visits and during one of our phone calls, we talk all the time. There's a free exchange of information that they would have known. I mean, I don't think that Don Ryder coming over to look at the system was indicative of us trying to sweep the problem under the table. It was indicative of us trying to fix the problem.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Inhofe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, Republican.
Things off your list. I've done a lot of crossing off. Let me just share a concern. During the last 3 hours, there have been 8 references to different newspaper accounts, some of them with the same newspaper several times. Of the articles that were written, there are 4 of them that have been categorically denied by you, General Abizaid, or by you, General Sanchez, and I believe you in that. Now, I know that you get, it leads me to believe this is so press-driven that it's just, this is out of control. But when you get your briefings every morning, I know you read the different articles in the paper that affect you, isn't that correct?
Yes, sir.
And there are many times that you have denied and found that they are in error, and I'm sure you have either directly or indirectly called that to the attention of the newspaper, the publication that gave those articles. Is that correct? You've done it right here in this setting.
Well, sir, there's a lot of things that are incorrect. I don't spend much time.
Well, I would hope you didn't, but I guess I'd ask this. Have you ever seen a retraction by any of these newspapers when something is proven to be wrong?
No, sir.
All right. Well, I haven't either. I think Senator Collins was right when she talked about all the good things that are happening that you just don't see in the media. And not just the humanitarian things that we see when we go over to Iraq and go to Afghanistan and see what these great guys and gals are doing and how much they're loved by the people over there. In the case of Afghanistan, General Abizaid, the Oklahoma's 45th, they've taken on the responsibility of training the ANA to train themselves. And they're doing a great job. When I was over there, I watched the expressions on the faces of the new commanders, Afghan commanders, teaching and training their troops. I mean, this is something that would be worthy, certainly, a publication. I dare say not half of 1% of the people in America know all these good things that are going on. And it breaks my heart to see you guys over here. I agree with what Senator Graham said, that we have to air this out and get it out in the public. But we've already had the Secretary of Defense, the Undersecretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and quite frankly, I'm sorry that you guys are here. I'd rather be handling this in some way where we can get your statement, get it in the record, and have that done with, because you have an awesome responsibility. General Sanchez, you're the, as this Task Force 7, that's all the Army, all the Navy, all the Air Force, all the Marines, all the coalition forces, all the allies. That's your responsibility in Iraq. Sure, and General Abizaid, you have that responsibility plus what's going on in Afghanistan. And by the way, I think Afghanistan's success story should serve and will serve as a model for what we're trying to get done in Iraq. So that's just one opinion. I know that you're anxious to get back to the battlefield, and that's where your mind is today, and that's where your heart is. I want to say this, though, and I did talk to Senator Warner, to our chairman, when I found you were going to be here, and he assured us that you had other reasons to be here. So perhaps that's takes care of that. I think some things are worth repeating. I think that until we see the Fay report, until we get the investigations, the results of the investigations, the results of the courts martial, we're not going to have the answers. I with this concept of undue command influence puts you in a very awkward position to say things, and I hope you, in your own minds, you haven't said anything that publicly that is going to interfere with the prosecution that's going on. Do you feel pretty comfortable that you've been able to do that?
Yes, sir, I do.
I look at what happened when things were discovered, and I was amazed with how quickly things were done, how quickly you took care of the problems that were there, that the guards were removed, the commanders were relieved, the criminal investigation started immediately. And that was long before the public even knew what was going on, long before the pictures came out. That was already happening. Maybe the system's broke, but it's not that it broke to the extent that you didn't perform immediately when you found out what was going on. I want to say one thing, and this is just an opinion. There are a lot of people who have been critical that just some of the guards, the seven guards that have been referred to many times, that they're taking the heat for all of this. I don't think there's an American out there, once they see the videos and the pictures that we at this table have seen of the behavioral pattern of these guards, would be at all critical of any kind of punishment that they would be subjected to. Now, I'm not saying anything that hasn't already been in the paper. I was very careful after I saw those not to say anything, but others did. And they talked about the fact this could be, it's like they're staging a porn film. Well, this is something that no one would condone. You folks wouldn't, no one else would. So I just think that we need to talk about the good things that have been happening and get you back in the battle where you belong. Let me just, before I run out of time, General Sanchez, there have been several things that you've taken away in terms of interrogation and techniques. Do you think that has harmed your ability to get the information that you need to have?
No, sir, it has not.
Okay, do you think that, and I think that also Colonel Warren, I believe it was you who talked about, yes, in cell block A1 or section A1 and AB, that those are the tough guys, those are the terrorists, those are the bad guys, but occasionally one gets in there who isn't. I would suggest that probably the profile of that individual got them there, and when you realized that they didn't belong there, you took them out. Is that, or I should ask you, General Miller, is that what you think might have happened?
So I wasn't there when they were used in cell block 1A and 1B, but in discussions, that was the intent early on in September.
Okay. Well, that's I knew that you weren't there at the time. In fact, I was down at Gitmo when you were there, and you just did great work down there. My time has expired, but I'd like to have – I'm glad that Senator Cornyn brought up something most significant, and that was did – any of the information that you have been able to get from these detainees prevent something bad from happening or saved American lives or saved coalition lives? And if so, are there any specific examples that you would like to share with us? In other words, you were successfully interrogating some of these people in that particular section. Was some of the information that you got helpful in in saving American lives or saving troops?
Senator, I do not know the answer to that. I certainly do know that in many cases, good interrogation techniques used by very smart people have saved the lives of an awful lot of Americans and Iraqis.
Yes, thank you very much.
If I could just add to that, General Sanchez is one of my new jobs as the Deputy Commander for Detainee Operations. Asked me to look at the intelligence function. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that half of the effort of the CJTF-7, now multinational forces, Iraq, is going down to the to develop actionable intelligence at the unit level. That saves soldiers' lives every day. The other 30% goes toward theater-level things that come down from the commander's decision or in taskings from other organizations. The other 20%, we just keep as a standby. It's used every day because of high profile. And so that system, that organization, works every day and every night to try to be able to provide actionable intelligence.
Thank you, General Miller. I hope that the media is paying attention to the answer you gave. I know my time is up, but Colonel Warren wanted to say something about Article 32 earlier on.
Colonel Warren.
Was there anything you'd like to say about Article 32? I think you were...
Well, sir, Article 32 of the Fourth Convention is the one that prohibits torture mm-hmm. and the conduct of medical experimentation and so forth. Those are grave breaches under the law of war.
Okay,
and, of course, obviously prohibited under our policies, under our values, our standards, our training, and our interrogation policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Inhofe.
Mr. Chairman, may I add something? As a result of the two visits from General Miller and then from General Ryder, the system that we put into place for intel fusion within CJTF-7 matured significantly because of the experience and the lessons and the integration of those lessons into the command under General Fast. There is absolutely no question in my mind that because of those two efforts, significant amounts of Americans' lives have been saved because of the turn in terms of from the time we find the information, develop the intelligence, and get it to the tactical level for action. Absolutely the right thing for us to have done, and I would do it again.
Thank you for that answer.
Thank you very much. General Sanchez, in my most recent visit, I met with General Fast. Would you kindly explain exactly the position that she occupies?
Yes, sir. Brigadier General Fast has been my Deputy Director for Intelligence, or Correction Director for Intelligence of the CJTF-7. Right.
Thank you very much. Senator Bayh.
Gentlemen, thank you for your service to our country under
this is Senator Evan Bayh, Democrat of Indiana.
The treatment at our hands today has been humane. I sometimes feel empathy for those of you who are on the receiving end of these hearings. General Abizaid, who was responsible for the staffing levels at the prison, for the number of MPs and prison guards?
The responsibility for staffing, I would say the responsibility for a unit coming with the right number of people belongs to the United States Army. The responsibility, if we have shortages, then devolves upon CJTF-7 to tell me so I can tell the Army to fix it.
The reason I ask is I understand Army doctrine calls for one MP per about 4,000 prisoners, and that here we had one battalion for what ultimately reached about 7,000 or slightly more prisoners, or about five times the number of detainees per guard or MP that the Army doctrine would call for. I'd like your opinion, and there have been some reports to this effect. Did this substantial overcrowding not excuse the behavior, of course, but did it contribute to an atmosphere which might have given rise in at least part to this aberrant behavior?
Well, it contributed to systemic failures at the prison. I think that's clear.
And it gets to my second and somewhat broader concern now that I've had a chance to reflect upon this whole set of circumstances, which is, and I'd like your opinion both with the benefit of hindsight and going forward about whether we have adequate troop strength in Iraq to accomplish our mission. I've been concerned from day one, and I know Senator McCain and some others have had this concern, that we didn't have adequate strength at the beginning to prevent some of this rampant looting that took place. We didn't have adequate troop strength to prevent some of the sabotage or vital infrastructure that took place. We didn't have adequate troop strength to immediately clamp down on the insurrection, which has now gathered a momentum all of its own. And I wonder if just in a microcosm, this is a, you know, just another manifestation of our sort of continual underestimation of the task that we've taken on here. And, you know, I guess in a situation like this where we're deposing a regime, we're trying to reconstitute a country with no history of democracy, it seems to me we should err on the side of having more strength than necessary rather than too little. Both looking back and looking forward, have we had adequate troop strength, and do we have adequate troop strength to accomplish our mission with this critical June 30th handover fast approaching?
Have we had adequate troop strength? Certainly in February, I would have told you absolutely. I mean, things were where we thought they would be, and did we anticipate that there would be additional violence that as we move towards a political process? We did, and that's the reason I asked for the troops from the 1st Armored Division and the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment to remain there, although we didn't specify them particularly. I would like to point out that one of the hugely good news stories that has been lost in this period of the Abu Ghraib scandal is the incredible work and bravery and selflessness and military capability of those two units in moving from positions in contact in Baghdad down into the south and fighting a very tough fight, as well as have been the Marines. But to answer your question directly, and forgive me for diverting, Senator McCain and I have had this opportunity many times to discuss it, and I appreciate his opinion. And there are certain types of troops that we don't have enough of, and we still don't have enough of them, and we got to figure out how to get them. And their MPs and their MI guys and their HUMINT guys and their civil affairs people. And we must build a force structure that allows us to be able to fight a war like this in the 21st century, and they're not in the force structure. You know, we have MPs on the scene that the Army has done a very good job in training that don't happen to be MPs. You know, we have Air Force truck units. I mean, we are doing things with our force structure that, in my view, we need to sit back from a service provider point of view and say, okay, what do we really need? Now, in terms of are there enough tanks, are there enough Bradleys, are there enough combat troops, Marines, et cetera, I'm pretty comfortable with that. It's the enablers I'm not comfortable with. And I'll end it up by saying I'm also not comfortable that there are enough international troops on the battlefield, because the effort needs to be not just American, but it needs to be international. Now, these are things that I've said, I believe, to the committee on numerous occasions, it's not new. But did I miscalculate the number of troops? Maybe. Maybe I miscalculated, but I think we've adjusted and we'll continue to adjust based on what the enemy does, because the enemy has a vote.
The civilian leadership always places this at your doorstep, saying that they're endeavoring to get you everything you need, and I certainly appreciate that. But Undersecretary Wolfowitz began to touch on this, I think, yesterday in some of his testimony up here in a different capacity, which is this was not only a military undertaking, this is a political undertaking. And I'm just wondering if, you know, those who felt that we were going to be greeted as liberating heroes, so to speak, perhaps didn't underestimate the magnitude of the societal transformation we have taken on. It goes way beyond the military purview, and I'm just wondering if, given the magnitude of that task, we have been understaffed, and this is just another manifestation of that.
Well, Senator, I can't comment for the political side of the House, but I can comment in saying that while we can't be defeated militarily, we're not going to win this thing militarily alone. We have to get everything together, economics, politics, intelligence, you name it, what information, it's all got to come together in a synchronized fashion that allows us to do this very, very important task. And it's really one of the hardest things that this nation has ever undertaken in this part of the world or anywhere else.
My last point, gentlemen, is several of you have indicated in response to recent questioning that lives have been saved, attacks have been prevented with access to timely and accurate intelligence. I think, General Miller, you've indicated that approximately 600 of these detainees are some of the worst of the worst, and that if released upon Iraqi society, they would not only imperil our forces but innocent Iraqis. Colonel Warren, I think you've indicated that the Geneva Convention would allow somewhat more vigorous interrogations of some of those kind of folks, but with the exception of a few requests for solitary confinement, we kind of haven't gone there. Is that all? That all correct? The stress positions were requested, but that wasn't permitted. Where I'm going with all this is that, you know, this is so important that we strike the right balance here. On the one hand, timely intelligence saves lives, innocent Iraqi lives, the lives of our troops. On the other hand, there's a dividing line beyond which our moral integrity, our honor, is vitally important if we're going to win this war against terrorism, because we do stand for something better. And so what's been brought before this committee with these pictures, which obviously go to the latter, who we are and what we stand for, let's not lose sight of the former either. The pictures that stick in my mind also, Mr. Chairman, are the pictures of the young men out there at Walter Reed, some of them missing arms, some of them missing legs, fractured lives in the full flower of their youth, the pictures that came out of those flag-draped caskets. Those pictures are important, too. So there's no excuse for the behavior, none, that gave rise to the pictures of this abuse at this prison. We have to root it out, and some of these individuals are on trial. But at the same time, let's not repeat some of the mistakes that we made in the area of covert intelligence, where the director of the CIA now tells us it's going to take 5 years to reconstitute our covert capabilities and adequately protect this country. So a balance is in order here, and I just hope that we are empowering you to strike that balance in ways that protect our brave men and women on the one hand and preserve our honor on the other.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any desire for any witness to speak? If not, Senator Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, I certainly
this is
want to
Senator Elizabeth Dole, Republican of North Carolina.
Your tremendous leadership, your outstanding service to our country, and like Senator Cornyn, I regard you as heroes sitting in front of me today, and I thank you for your time with us. And since all of you have been very forthcoming in the past 3 hours of questions, I'd like to take this opportunity to ask some questions with regard to your overall Iraqi operations, to go beyond. First of all, though, General Miller, let me ask you, would you clarify who will be in charge of running the Iraqi prison system after June 30th?
Senator, that's still in dialogue and discussion between the Coalition Provisional Authority and the Interim Governing Council and now the soon-to-be Interim Iraqi Government. Those transitions are working. I'll tell you that as far as multinational forces Iraq, our plan is to continue to run our theater level, our multinational forces Iraq 3 detention facilities and other detention facilities that allow us to ensure we can implement a safe and secure environment. But as we work toward transition, every day I meet with my Iraqi counterparts to see how we can more successfully move to integrate this operation.
Thank you. Now, in an intercepted letter written by Al-Qaeda operative Zarqawi, we were given insight to a terrorist message that was very significant and compelling. In noting concern that he may lose a foothold in Iraq, he wrote, and I quote, "With the spread of the army and the police, our future is becoming frightening." He went on to detail the very environment of chaos his network requires to succeed: attacks on Iraqi security forces, the targeting of Kurds, the Shia populations, and the killing of Americans, the very environment evolving in Iraq that he feared the coalition forces would suffocate. General Abizaid, several reports have claimed that Zarqawi is in Baghdad. If he actually got into Baghdad past coalition forces, can we assume that he has the mobility to move to other regions in Iraq?
Senator Dole, I would assume that Zarqawi has the ability to move around the nation, unfortunately. The nature of the insurgency is one that you can't stop one person from moving where you'd like them to move, even as visible as they may be. He can move around, he can strike at will, and we have reason to believe that he was in Jordan recently and had his hands in the plot that would have killed thousands and thousands of Jordanians. That was foiled by
That's right.
The king's the King's special forces and intelligence forces. So there is a great battle going on in the region. It not only extends to Iraq, but it's in Saudi Arabia. It should come as no surprise to the committee that these people are also attacking foreigners in places like Saudi Arabia. There is a strategy at work here that we should not lose sight over, and it's happening in Afghanistan, and it's happening in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and elsewhere in the region, and it's also happening in places like Madrid.
Can you confirm that Zarqawi beheaded Nicholas Berg?
I don't know that I can confirm that it was him. I know that there are various reports of people saying it's his voice. I know he's claimed it. But it certainly wouldn't be past him.
General Kimmett said that the killing of Salim had the classic hallmarks of Zarqawi. Do you have any further information to share with us on that?
No, Senator. I wouldn't want to give Zarqawi any stature he doesn't deserve. He's a murderer, he's a torturer, and that's the status he deserves.
Do you have any indication that al-Qaeda is coordinating with al-Sadr's resistance?
That's a very good question, but I think the answer is no. But in that part of the world, you never know.
Saddam Hussein's government was believed to have produced several hundred tons of sarin as well as stockpiles of mustard gas. Now the presence of both sarin and mustard gas has been reported in Baghdad. Do our men and women in theater have the equipment, the devices that they need in order to protect themselves from exposure, from the exposure to such agents as these? General Sanchez?
Yes, ma'am. The answer is yes, we do. We deploy with all of our chemical, nuclear, biological capabilities, and those are present.
General Abizaid, defense contractors and private business representatives, of course, are critical to reconstruction efforts and rebuilding in Iraq. Terrorists seem to have shifted their focus. They're targeting these unarmed civilians. A corporation from my home state of North Carolina, Blackwater, of course, with four contractors who were shot, burned, hung from a bridge, Nick Bird's murder. What are you doing to provide increased security for these unarmed civilians?
I think it's best left for General Sanchez to talk the details, but it's clear that the enemy has discovered a vulnerability in the contracting system. It's also clear that we've got to work with them to protect them, not only in coordinating with Iraqi security services, but with our own. For example, we should not have convoys moving around areas that we know to be very violent without some sort of coordination with the military, and that's happened before, and that's got people into trouble before. Rick?
General Sanchez, do you want to answer that as well?
Yes, ma'am.